Welcome to the Growing Leaders Podcast. Mary Steves here alongside our fearless leader, Dr. Tim Elmore, and friend and colleague, Andrew McPeak. Today's conversation is all about a term that is taking the education world by storm. This conversation is going to be helpful no matter what field you're in, whether it's education, training, or coaching. Everyone will want to stay tuned for the research Tim and Andrew will share, as well as the practical applications. Andrew, why don't we kick off this conversation?
Thanks so much, Mary. Tim, I'm excited for this conversation today because we're really talking about engagement. And a lot of times when we use that term, we say student engagement, but engagement is a huge subject, an important subject for all industries, right? Bosses want to know that their employees are engaged. Yeah. Coaches want to know that the players listening to them in practice. So engagement is such a huge concept. You and I have been talking about this for months and even years, talking about this engagement. And you told me a story a few months ago that I thought was just a perfect picture for how engagement became so clear for you as why this is so important. I'd love to start off by just having you tell us that story and how you learned about the importance of engagement.
Sure, Andrew. Well, I think I've profiled it this way to you. I stumbled onto the greatest discovery about teaching and learning years ago accidentally, I'm ashamed to say. I was mentoring a group of university students in San Diego, and one of the students that was in my group emailed me, sent me a note, and just said, who's going to pick the topic for our next session? I grabbed my computer and quickly typed in, I can do that. Or at least that's what I thought I typed in. I was not aware that the letter I and the letter U are right next to each other on my keyboard. And so I accidentally sent the message, you can do that. And the rest is history. I showed up at the next meeting. I drew a breath to say, to start the meeting. I couldn't even get any words out. They jumped in thinking I'd empowered them to lead. And I mean, they set up the icebreaker question, they picked the topic, they had video, they had experiences, they had practical steps at the end. It was marvelous. I was never so proud as when I watched those university students take the ball and run with it on their own. And Andrew, I never told them it was a mistake on my part. But what I learned that day was so powerful for me to realize I had a better group when I didn't say much.
Wow.
And I know every teacher would probably say, yeah, I do remember something like that. But what if we did that on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is probably for people who are listening, they're thinking, oh, well, I've told my kids to lead a group of a class before or whatever it is. But the reality is there's actually a scientific term for this, and it's a term called metacognition. I wonder if you could set up that term for us and just talk maybe kind of what that's about.
Absolutely. Well, what I learned way back then was all about metacognition. And metacognition, or thinking about thinking, is really the secret to and the driving force, I believe, behind all true learning. When I download information, you can hear it and understand it, but your memory of it is a crapshoot. You know, especially next final, you know, you're cramming. I just believe the natives of today, these students we're trying to teach, it's how they learn best. It's when they get to do stuff on their own. So if we want our students to learn as much as possible, then we'll want to maximize the amount of metacognition they're doing. It's a relatively simple equation, but here's the equation. The more learners reflect on their learning, the more they learn. The better they engage in the subject and how to communicate it to others themselves, the more they actually own it. Haven't we said this before? I never learned so much about that topic as when I had to teach it to somebody.
Absolutely.
You know, we've all said that.
Absolutely.
This is metacognition. It's a simple application to this incredible discovery that researchers at Harvard and others are making and realizing this is turning students upside down in a very good way.
Fascinating. So if this is true, right, if people are listening to this now and thinking, yeah, that sounds right, that makes sense, all those kinds of things, and yet it feels like it's more rare, right? More often it's just the teacher standing up in the front, they talk for 50 minutes straight and send the kids out of the classroom. Yeah. So why do you think, if this is true, if we're seeing research that's supporting this concept, why aren't more people doing it?
Yeah, well, I think universities that are teaching education, that have an education major, or they're even a teaching school, are starting to do some things that are different today. But most of the time, over the decades, at least during my lifetime, we've been taught to lecture, drill, memorize, and test. You know, this is how learning takes place. So we're not prepared to utilize metacognition, at least very well. Mm. We feel we're not really doing our job as an educator or employer unless we're talking. You know, that's how I lead. I talk.
Yeah.
And really, this sounds so ironic, but the best instructors do very little instructing verbally.
Fascinating.
So it's what every instructor dreams of when their students own the topic and they're weighing in, they're talking about it, they're experimenting and writing down what they, you're thinking, oh my gosh, why didn't you do this yesterday? Well, because yesterday you were doing all that. You know, we were, most classrooms are set up for the teacher to do the metacognition, not the student. Mm-hmm. We're processing what we're thinking, and, you know, and so forth. So I often call us, the trainer teacher, the over-functioning teacher. Mm-hmm. Just like we talk about over-functioning parents that are helicopters, you know, flying in and doing too much. Teachers, we get mad at them. I think they could get mad at us. We're taking away some of the discovery that students need to do themselves. Mm.
This is huge. This is huge, Tim. This actually reminds me when I was when I first started leading, I had a series of college interns, and we would go around and do these conferences. And one of the things that we discovered was, you know, I loved leading these interns, but what we started doing was actually giving them some ownership over the things that we wanted to cover. As soon as we started doing that, what we noticed was student engagement increased in our conferences. Now, because I wasn't the one speaking at the front, you know, sometimes the conversation might go a little helter-skelter.
A little messy,
But what I found was the engagement was higher because, you know, the students that we were working with were hearing multiple voices. Yeah. There was a more youthful voice coming from the interns, and it was just, there was a lot more connection. So I've totally seen this happen.
Well, here's how I started my career. As I began teaching students way back in 1979, I considered that I need to know my subject, so I need to work hard to know my subject. I need to engage my students, so I need to be very creative, and I don't think any of that's wrong. We need to be creative. But I worked to be so engaging that no matter what preoccupied the minds of the students, the ball game tonight, the next weekend, my girlfriend, a video game, whatever, my class would grip them and hold their attention. Still, however, I would find that some students would check out, and I thought, was I not a good teacher? And the problem was, maybe I was too good. Maybe I was so preoccupied with what I was doing that I was taking it away.
That is so helpful for me, Tim, as I'm thinking through this concept. But I wonder if you could get, you know, just really help us see what is it we do practically, us as teachers, that's really a part of the problem. Where are we messing ourselves up when it comes to this metacognition thing?
It's the paradox of all paradoxes, I think. Teachers can actually prevent learning in the classroom. I've done it myself. Here's how it works, at least works for me. I go in with some assumptions into my learning environment. Number one, I must work hard to know my subject. If I'm going to get paid to do this, I need to work hard to learn my subject. My problem is I need to be asking, do I ask students to do so too? Because they're the ones who are going to have to own it later. Number two, second assumption, I need to put creativity into my lesson plan, of course. But my problem is, do I require any creativity on the part of the students? Often not. Three, a third assumption, I reflect on what I want them to gain, so I'm thinking about outcomes. But again, the problem, do I give time for students to do this? What do I want to get out of this? Fourth assumption, I prepare for the class time if I'm a good teacher. My problem is, do my students prepare for the class time? Maybe, maybe not. And then finally, my fifth assumption, I really want to own the responsibility for the teaching. I should. But the problem, of course, is, do they, those students, take ownership? To learn. So this is the dilemma I think we have. It's not the worst crime in the world, but it does prevent learning from happening every day here in America.
That's spot on, Tim. I think that's really helpful for us. We've actually mentioned up to this point that this is a research-based concept, metacognition, and it's a term that's really being popularized out of Harvard University. So I wonder, could you set us up with some of the, where is this research coming from? What kind of things are they saying about metacognition?
Sure. Well, one of the pieces that became popular some years ago was from Eric Mazur, who is a physics professor at Harvard University. He was teaching some of the smartest students in the world. You know, Harvard gets the brightest and the best. But he was amazed that these students just weren't getting the subject. He was stunned, in fact, he said, as he discovered how little they really understood about physics. So the thing he started doing was he started turning over the teaching to the students. So he stumbled into metacognition by saying, why don't you teach each other? Now, that could look really bad. I mean, if his dean walks in and says, what the heck are you doing here?
Yeah.
Well, I'm really actually helping them learn. They could argue, no, you're not. You're quiet. But what happened was he started noticing these students engaged like never before, grades started reflecting their engagement, and this started the flipped classroom movement, which we all know about now in K-12 and higher ed, that we flip the classroom, we turn it around, we perhaps put the lecture on a video for them to watch at night, so the classroom time is much more experiential, much more the students doing something rather than the teacher doing something. The students are less passive, more participative, and it's just powerful. So in 2005, Andrew, the National Academy of Sciences summarized everything we know about learning in a report called How Students Learn. I'd say that's pretty clever.
Yeah.
Their research actually culminates in a single term, metacognition. The NAS identified this word as the key to effective learning. Quite literally, meta means behind or over, and cognition means the act of knowing. So our task is to increase the amount of metacognition, or seeing how I'm thinking about this and reflecting on it so that I can proceed much, much better. So it's powerful. So in the Marching Off the Mat book that's going to be coming out, we actually summarize this. I talk about moving from a traditional pedagogy or style to a transformational pedagogy. Let me just give the listeners, Andrew, just three quick ideas for them to kind of marinate on. So in the traditional pedagogy, the way we learned to do it, students are consumers. In fact, I've actually heard college students say, I'm a customer. I'm paying you good money, so you better give me an A. So traditional pedagogy, students are consumers. In the transformational pedagogy, using metacognition, students are creators. In the traditional pedagogy, teachers are commanders, and, you know, trying to do crowd control in front of the class. In transformational pedagogy, teachers are consultants. So I'm going to be a consultant to you, but you're actually doing the work. And then finally, in the traditional pedagogy, it fosters complacency. We all know complacent students. Some of you listening have them right there in front of your nose every day.
Yeah.
In the transformational pedagogy, it fosters contribution. And you actually get the students doing more. And if you can, listeners, if you can put up with this, that they're actually going to do more and it's a little messier, it could transform the engagement in your classroom.
Yeah, I feel that, because as I'm listening to what you're saying, I'm feeling like this is an absolute imperative, right? We've got all this research backing this up. Yeah. We do need to create a way for our students to be higher, more engaged, and own their learning in the classroom. But there's probably, if I know our listeners, there's probably somebody listening who's thinking, you don't know my 10th graders, you know?
Yeah.
If I let them take control of the class, Lord knows what's going to happen, you know, anything could happen. So I wonder if you can address that question of how does this really look practically within the systems? You know, especially teachers, they have standards they have to meet. You know, coaches are thinking about winning. We just all have standards we have to keep up with.
Sure.
So what does it look like to give ownership but still maintain the same, we're still in the same systems that we're in, and we still have to operate in the same way that we've been operating in some ways.
Yeah, and herein lies our problem, really. We've been practicing something. We have muscle memory for another way of doing it, and now we've got to change our ways. So I just want every listener to understand and hear me say now, I fully recognize this pedagogy is fundamentally different than the one most teachers or parents have used with their young. Teachers, Andrew, like you just said, feel the pressure to produce students who generate certain test scores, so they spiral unwittingly into teach for the test. Have we not heard this term and even used this term? We'd say, I don't like it, but I have to. If we're going to get the revenue we need from the state or federal government, we've got to get test scores up, and that means I just get to the answers. Here's something interesting. Bayer surveyed called The Facts of Science Education. Nearly all teachers believe hands-on science lessons serve kids best, but 4 out of 5 teachers say their school teaches for the test. So we're admitting, I know this is a better idea, but there's no way in my current system we can do it. But by the end of this podcast, Andrew, I'm going to suggest some very practical ideas in the current classroom or field or court or business place we've got that we can actually do it in, today.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So, Tim, I know we're getting close to the end, but I want to talk about one more thing. I know you have a ton of experience leading kids, and you often use this terminology of difference makers. And I really think of those as these are the ideas that are going to take your teaching or your leadership or whatever it is to the very next level. So I know that you have a few difference makers that you associate with this student engagement metacognition piece. So can you share those with us?
Yeah, absolutely. This dawned on me. It was an epiphany for me as a leader and a teacher, when I realized we now live in a world where students can look up anything. So unlike when I was a kid, I needed the teacher to do more teaching.
Yeah.
That's my only source. Now the sources are Wikipedia, Google, and Bing, and everything else. So we have to move to this just because of the day we're living in. So I assembled a simple list. This may be old news, but I think it's going to be helpful to listeners. Let me give you about a dozen ideas or conclusions, like you said, that I've drawn about teaching and learning. One is students support what they help create. I know some athletic coaches right now, Andrew, who are empowering students to decide how practice goes, what the players do, how long they do it, and when they do it. And they're getting surprising results. So I'm asking the listeners right now, how could you give ownership to where even if they don't come up with the best idea, it's their idea and they do it, rather than it's your idea and half of them do it. So that's number one, students support what they help create. The second conclusion I've drawn is that students learn better when they expect to teach what they learn. This was a huge part of Eric Mazur's experience discovering metacognition at Harvard. If you bring up, you're going to be teaching this, you know, that's when I pay attention. When my mama says, you're about to do this. And, okay, mom, what is it again? You know? So I have a friend who's a professor in Texas named George. He shifted all of his preparation for midterms and finals to students helping students learn. Grades went up for everybody in the class when he stopped talking and they started talking. Mm. Number three, I believe students are incentivized if they know why the topic is relevant beforehand. You know, you've heard me say this, Andrew, if we do the why before the what, we have better results. I know two teachers that did an experiment. It was anecdotal, but they both taught sophomore geometry, and they decided to do an experiment. One decided to teach in the typical way he had in the past. Open your textbooks to page 73, section 4, blah, blah, blah. The other teacher decided to take a few minutes at the beginning of every class and review why this particular day was going to be so relevant for their future. Well, you can imagine the students were way more engaged in that class and his grades reflected at the end of the semester. So I encourage our listeners, do a why first. Yeah, you're taking time, but you'll make the most of the 44 minutes left if you do that than if you took all 15 minutes to just talk about the what. Hmm. Four, students bond more with an experience than a lecture. This one probably doesn't need much elaboration. We growing up, bonded more with an experience. So when we had those teachers that did that science experiment or some wild thing out in the quad area rather than just in the classroom, and it was very different, we remembered that day. It's just how we're hardwired as human beings. So I love schools that do project-based learning, where the class becomes an experience, not just an explanation. And I'll tell you what, this is hard for me. I love to explain. I want to explain everything.
Yeah.
But again, I think we'd all agree, experiences are what they bond with. Five, students engage more holistically when music is connected to the subject. Hmm. I know there are listeners right now that use music in the classroom, and they're not music teachers. But there's lyrics to a 21 Pilots song or a Katy Perry song or whatever that they found, and now they're using them. Well, you know, students are engaged now because that's a song they've got on their playlist. So again, using music is just powerful. Did we not learn our ABCs by singing our ABCs? So
true.
Again, we've got to think about our lesson plans and the way we're delivering our content as employers or parents. But I just think music is just what students remember. And so we need to use it. Six, students retain more when they physically gesture when they learn. Now, this is very interesting. This is part of my digging and my research. But I remember at some youth camps growing up, you know, doing hand gestures to songs and so forth and so on. But teachers are actually doing this now, and they're simply finding that when you form body or hand gestures while you're saying something, somehow it just, it makes it stick in your brain. Probably because you're using more than one sense. Mm-hmm. There's touch and sound and sight or whatever. But my son took a sign language class for his foreign language and found that gestures actually accelerated his learning because sign language is all about hand gestures. So again, I want listeners to think through, how could I incorporate gesturing, and I mean the good kind, in the classroom, actually help students learn? All right, a few more. Number 7, students absorb more when more than two senses are involved. I touched on this just a minute ago. I often love the examples that come to us from Finland. The test scores are so high from that little country in Europe. But students grasp and retain more when they don't merely listen to lectures, but they touch, smell, taste, hear, and see the topic. There are experiments they do in wooded areas where students are walked outside and they're blindfolded and they find a tree and they walk around it and do all sorts of things, and they remember what they learned. So we probably don't do this more because it seems very silly and not academic, but it's exactly what makes students remember. Mm. All right. Number 8, students understand a larger percentage when they must practice it. Now, this is why homework was first invented, you know, years and years and years ago. But I actually think it's more than just a writing assignment, even though I love writing. Students learn on a need-to-know basis. Would you not agree? All learn on completely. A need-to-know. I don't remember instructions that are given to me hypothetically, but the moment I need to fix that pipe in my bathroom, now I'm trying to remember what that plumber said. So we need to engage the need-to-know. We need to create it. So I believe when we come up with an application, we're going to accelerate their learning. They know they've got to do it, not just teach it.
Yeah.
9, students connect with a subject when allowed to connect with each other.
Hmm.
So this is called, it's community learning, it's social-emotional learning, but it's allowing students to actually form smaller learning communities within the larger classroom, perhaps. And Russian psychologists introduced this idea to us decades ago based on their research. But they're just saying basically that students learn better in circles than in rows. You've heard me say this a lot, Andrew, but there is no life change without life exchange. Mm. So we're letting them exchange life. Now, somebody might say, well, doesn't it get messy? Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Does it take longer? Oh, you bet it does. You get through less. But boy, what you get through. It sticks. Mm. And students, again, own the ideas because they're discussing them. Just a few more. 10, students comprehend information when it's connected to a narrative. We talk here a lot about narrators, the metaphor and the narrative. We just believe this is a huge handle for learning. Now, this does not mean we're saying you shouldn't go deep or didactic with learning. I believe there's lots of data that history class needs to teach. But if a teacher can come up with a story on General Ulysses S. Grant before he gets into the dates, and so we're more apt to learn it. Yeah. We all remember stories. I bet last week if you went to a conference or you heard a preacher preach a sermon, we remember the story. It was the story that we retained. So again, I'm just saying, what if we reintroduce this to the classroom? 11, students grasp new subjects when teachers connect it to familiar subjects. So this is utilizing the schema idea that we all learned way back at the university ourselves. Schemas are simply frameworks with which we learn things. And I'm simply saying, if you're trying to introduce a really new idea that students just don't get, they've never heard this term before, if you can attach it to an already familiar idea, they're much more apt to be able to file it away in their mental filing cabinet. So you're simply coming up with analogies, metaphors. In fact, Andrew, our habitudes, our schemas, they are attaching a new idea that students can practice to an old one like an iceberg or rivers yep. and floods or whatever. And then one last one. Students remember data when an image is utilized in the learning. This is a second cousin to what I just shared. It's why we developed habitudes. A picture really is worth 1,000 words. And if we're wanting student engagement, images, visuals, emojis, Instagram, memes, they're everywhere now, except for the classroom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we're a bunch of words, but no pictures. So I just want to encourage you educators that might be listening, or even parents or employers. It sounds very anecdotal, but this might be the very thing that makes an idea stick in the minds of your listeners.
This is great, Tim. This is great. I think these are difference makers that will actually really make a difference if we start understanding them and applying them to the situations where we're leading the next generation.
Before we dive into our practical application segment, I have some exciting news for you. If you'd like to go deeper into the subject, Tim and Andrew have a brand new book coming out called Marching Off the Map, Inspire Students to Navigate a Brand New World. You can pre-order your copy today at growingleaders.com and receive several bonus items for free.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah, Tim, we've talked about so much great stuff today. You've given us so many things to really think about, but I wonder, there's probably teachers out there who are like, I'm going to be in the classroom tomorrow, or a business leader that's like, I'm going to be in front of my employees tomorrow. So can you give us some really practical things, things that we can do immediately that are going to increase this metacognition, this student engagement inside of our leadership with students?
Yeah, I sure will, Andrew. I recognize that all teachers don't have the luxury of flipping their class tomorrow. And employers say, I got to meet a bottom line. I got to sell some products or services, and I can't turn the whole day into a learning experience where we're walking around outside. So I believe, though, we can take some simple steps right now. And so I'll just give a short list of ideas to ignite metacognition immediately. Here's one. Create problems without offering solutions. So you're doing the exact opposite of what you typically would do. You're trying to be a solution person, but you actually create a problem without offering the answer. Ask, don't tell. Bring up a genuine dilemma in our world and suggest that students consider how to resolve it. So in a classroom, this is obvious. You just throw it out there and say, I'm not even going to lead you with it. You tell me what you would do. When I was a parent, once in a while, I would have my own two children, young children, watch the news and pick a news story and say, if I was in charge of that, what would I do? So I think there's ways you can practice. You come up with a problem, and you tell me what you would do, and we're less prescriptive here in allowing them to own it. Here's another idea. At least once a day, I laugh as I say this, refuse to answer a student's question. I know they're going to get mad at you, and you got to be okay with that. But instead, encourage everyone in the class to look up the answers and see what they find. So you're pressing them to that Google reflex where they're going to have to look it up themselves, but you're not going to be the answer person that perhaps you once were. Here's a third idea. Create disequilibrium. Now, this is so critical, and we all believe this, at least if you were taught to teach. But we rarely do it because we just don't like awkward, quiet moments or awkward, angry moments, which can happen today. And you know what disequilibrium is? It's that awkward period of silence between the time a problem is clear and the moment of solution comes or arises. So I think we just need to allow for discomfort and silence and be okay with that and just say, I think the important thing is we're going to one day come up with a solution to this. So I know teachers that actually allow this to go on for almost an entire class period. I mean, you can imagine the awkwardness. People are wanting to use the restroom because it's more active in there than it is in the classroom. I know one prof in the state of Indiana that lets it go on for almost the entire fall semester. It's not until late November, early December that he unveils this thing they've struggled through. But struggle is a good thing. Angela Duckworth, who wrote the book Grit, talks about she wasn't allowing her students to struggle enough when she started turning that around and allowing them to do the disequilibrium thing. Here's another one. Instead of traditional grading of papers, tests, or essays, communicate how many mistakes were made on their project and then turn them loose to find each one. So you're reversing the whole thing. They're finding the problems. You just say, look for four of them. Four of them aren't right. This could totally lead to metacognition. Five, choose a day and let students plan the entire lesson for the class period. In fact, let them record themselves teaching it and then evaluate themselves afterwards. I love this. You're turning them loose. It takes longer. It's more messy, but it's worth it. Number six, in your next exam, write in the wrong answers on those blanks, the very ones students have given in class, and then let students grade the test, finding the proper answers. So you're listening to all the class discussion that's happened. Some very wrong answers have been, offered. And so you're putting those in and saying, these are wrong. You got to find the right ones. And then one last idea I'll offer. Ask students to pick a topic they feel they've mastered, be it a video game, a sport, or a social media app, and then have them write down how they mastered it and discuss it. My guess is they're going to realize, I practice metacognition. So I would leave them with that list, and I think it's something we can do right now.
Tim and Andrew, thank you so much for the insightful conversation today. To our listeners, we thank you for leading the next generation, and we'll see you next time.